not that much planned for today. So finish discussing a bit of the symmetry TFT approach to the description of generalized symmetries or symmetries in general. Let me just briefly recall what the picture was we had last week. So there's a thing called a quiche, which consists of a topological theory sigma, and then a topological boundary condition rho. So this is a collection of an n, so this sits in dimension n plus 1. This is n dimensional, and then this, the pair of sigma and rho, this is called a n-dimensional quiche. And this is what is an abstract symmetry structure, and then we can ask to realize it in a concrete physical system. And this is then given by specifying some non-topological boundary condition. We call it F tilde. And then I can look at this sandwich type construction here, which will correspond to some n-dimensional field theory and F, and then giving an isomorphism between the sandwich and the field theory realizes the symmetry described by the quiche here as a symmetry of this not necessarily topological field theory F. And what you should think of as somehow the elements of a group are the topological operators in the quiche. So there can be things like line operators which are constrained to the boundary, but there can also be operators which might be constrained or live in the bulk. And then you can move from bulk operators to boundary operators. And all these things, when we do this dimensional reduction or the sandwich type of thing, they will give us topological operators living in there. And then one can argue somehow with the operators in here, things about operators on the boundary. So for example, if I have an operator constrained to the boundary and something in the bulk, then they will always commute because I can move a bulk operator past the boundary operator. While in this picture, line operators on the boundary would not commute. I cannot move them past each other. Okay. And again, this is somehow one way of thinking about symmetries in quantum field theories. And also this includes non-invertible and higher form symmetries as various examples.
What is theta?
It's an isomorphism of field theory. So when I do the sandwich, this will give me some field theory. And then I want it to be isomorphic to my fixed theory F. Oh. Yeah. Okay, and what we just want to do today is figure out how to gauge a symmetry in the setting. So the symmetry is some quiche, and now I want to formulate a theory of gauging such a symmetry. So that's what we are going to do.
Maybe another, before going there. So in some sense, isolating the information of the symmetry or the topological operators, like somehow that information can be isolated from the original QFT and then put inside the quiche.
Yes.
Also, I suppose the quiche is also encoding how these topological operators behave in a way. Like you mentioned something about a group structure.
Yes.
And so here, like, there is this sort of generalized notion of group structure as well, insofar as these defects can interact.
Yeah, you can take two defects, you can fuse them together to give another defect. You might be able to fuse them in different directions, leading to different defects.
Okay, and so maybe the question would be, do these introduce any extra structure, or, and partly because maybe I don't remember from last lecture, but do these introduce any extra structure, or do they distill faithfully the notion of a topological operator and the QFT?
Yes, they do, but I mean, so let us look at this one-dimensional example, right?
Yes.
then what they tell you is that there are some operators living here.
Yeah, and they compose.
And they compose in one direction. But you also have some operators living here.
Yeah, and they commute.
And they commute with all these things. So they compose in more,
yeah,
more interesting ways somehow.
Yeah, for instance, like that's one aspect. Like there should be operators that belong to the center, and should they commute with everything?
Yeah.
In this case, those become operators in the bulk.
Yeah.
But that seems like an extra piece of data within this frame. Like it could have been that, however we model them, it's only boundary operators and they commute. It just so happens that these commute, but you know what I mean?
I mean, somehow, if you have a bulk operator, you can always move it to the boundary, right?
Yeah.
And then this, what happens on the boundary will also tell you what it will be in the sandwich. But somehow having this distinction between bulk and boundary somehow gives you more structure, right? It makes certain structures you have more. Like if I imagine here, if I have something like line operators in the bulk, they can do weird grading type things, right?
Yeah.
And you would see all these type of operations you can do in the bulk here, you would see as relations for the boundary operators.
Ah, for instance, that's a great question. That's actually a great point, right? For instance, it's not obvious that these lines should have grading properties in the QFT. And here, if the dimensions match right, there will be grading properties.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is the case that one would expect the grading properties, even though it wasn't obvious in the native QFT originally?
I mean, there are certain lines where you will have these properties. Yes, these are somehow the bulk lines, which are usually something like the center of the boundary lines.
Okay.
And I mean, also in low dimensions, there are not that many things which can happen. But in high dimensions, there are a lot of different operators which can interact in reasonably complicated ways. And this formulism somehow like doesn't force you to actually figure out what these ways are. You just say, oh, it's whatever happens in the TFT. So you can draw a bunch of pictures. Somehow I never have to list all the type of operations I can have or something like that.
You somehow define them through the TFT.
Yes. And I mean, the other advantage is that we somehow know how to work with TFTs. There's no need for coming up with a new structure. So what we want to do now, essentially we should think of this as something as being a Dirichlet boundary condition for the quiche, and we want to define what it is to have a Neumann boundary condition. And then gauging will put the Neumann boundary condition here.
What is the boundary condition we have now, Dirichlet?
This is something like Dirichlet. I mean, right, if you have a quantum field theory, it doesn't really make sense to talk about a Dirichlet boundary or a Neumann boundary condition, because there might be a duality exchanging the two. So right, it's not something which makes sense without a classical description, but we should think of this as a Dirichlet boundary condition. And in the case of Diagraph-Witten theory, it was a boundary condition which came from the map of a point to the classifying space of the group. So this requires all the G bundles on the boundary to be trivial. So this is a condition on the field, so it's a Dirichlet boundary condition. So it restricts the value of the field and not the value of the derivative. What do I want to say? Okay, now I have sigma, which is some n-dimensional, n plus one-dimensional TFT, and R, which is a right boundary. So I have something sitting here. Then there's a construction I can do, which from this I also get something which I call RL, which is the left boundary. And how I get this is I just take the boundary condition R, but then before I evaluate it on a boundary, I reverse the orientation of the boundary. So now there's like this right, left and right is somehow distinguished by these arrows pointing in or out with respect to a given orientation. So if I reverse the orientation on the boundary, this will turn right boundaries into left boundaries. So there's a left boundary constructed by orientation. And based on this, we can give the following definition. So we fix a quiche and then we say Neumann boundary epsilon, so it's a topological boundary condition. Some topological boundary condition such that if I look at the following type of sandwich picture, so I have sigma, then I have my topological boundary rho, and on the other side I can put epsilon, and then I look at the left boundary. So I can look at this type of sandwich, and if this sandwich is trivial, so I have some isomorphism omega, then I say epsilon L is a Neumann boundary condition. Yeah. So to me it's maybe a different word would be transversal. So it's a boundary condition which is transversal to the original boundary condition. Well, so if I do this type of sandwich thing, I get the trivial theory. And then in the example...
Can you explain intuitively why?
What?
Why that is true?
Can I explain what I could?
Sorry, like in an intuitive way?
I mean, imagine this is a Dirichlet boundary condition, and then you have a Neumann boundary condition, and they're both topological. So this fixes the value of the fields, this fixes the value of the derivatives. And then there's, because it's topological, nothing is happening on the interval, so you have completely fixed your field. So the theory becomes trivial. I mean, you might also want to call it a transversal boundary.
Also, when a theory has boundaries, I'm supposed to take this image and map it into something. There's a functor that's doing something here, no?
Yeah.
So you're mapping it into the identity map.
This is the trivial theory. So it's a theory which just assigns the complex numbers to everything and the identity to every type of Bordism.
Okay. Should it, no, because is this a, so this is not a specific manifold?
No, this is really a statement about theories.
Yeah, so it's a statement about theories. So it's a statement about how it would be applied to any manifold, I suppose.
Yeah, so if you look at it at a manifold M, right, then I can look at M times 0, 1. And then I can put rho as a boundary condition here and epsilon L as a boundary condition here. And then evaluate the full theory on this manifold with two boundary conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the statement would be that this is, like depending on the dimension of M, this would either be, the partition function would be 1, the state space would be just the complex numbers and so on.
So, okay.
Right, it's like, this would be dim M equals N, and this would be for the dimension of M equals N minus 1. But just the requirement that this theory is trivial. And the example for Digraph-Witten theory is just given by looking at the identity map from BG to BG. So the this Neumann boundary condition doesn't fix the field at all in this setting. And if you recall from last lecture, also if there's a co-cycle here, living on the space, then to get a boundary condition, I need to trivialize it under the pullback. But I can only trivialize a co-cycle under the pullback along the identity if it's already trivial. So a Neumann boundary condition only exists when the co-cycle is trivial, in this diagraph written example. And then the other example is in one dimension. So the quiche is the sigma is two-dimensional. Then sigma we should think of as something as an algebra. And the left the right boundary is just sigma as the regular module over itself, and then epsilon is something like a module structure on C or an augmentation of the algebra. So you should think of this other boundary epsilon L as an augmentation for your algebra. Okay. And now we can define what it means to gauge a theory. So
maybe just also because I still have very little intuitions about Dykert-Witten theory. But yes, and I'm failing to see somehow this is related to Kozul duality, by the way. I think somehow these two things could be Kozul dual or something.
Yes.
I just would like some more intuition. Like, what are we aiming at here? Like, you have a quiche, so it's a boundary theory plus a topological theory, a left boundary theory, and you're putting something on the right. What is trying to be accomplished?
I mean, what I want to accomplish is to say what it means to gauge the symmetry described by the quiche.
And
I haven't told you that what would happen now. So we can define F.
Or maybe just one other thing, so if sigma is an algebra, I suppose is a commutative algebra?
No.
And the things in row are not commutative?
Because, I mean, so how this looks is we have this setting, right? And then here we have some point operators.
Sure.
They form an algebra. And then there's the bulk.
Yeah.
It would be the center of the
so
algebra.
So sigma is both the row piece and the boundary. And
yeah, I would better say this is like some of this quiche corresponds to an algebra.
Okay. And yes, I know that epsilon assigns a number, like it maps the thing to a number,
yeah.
Elements of the algebra.
Right, and then if I look at a picture like where I have A here and epsilon here, if I do this type of thing, it's the relative tensor product of A with C. So this will give me C. Right, this.
Oh, what is that? What is the relative tensor product?
It's something you can form for, it's what this dimensional reduction does algebraically. You see, I mean, so we have A, and then I have C. And you might think that this this sandwich type thing would just be A tensor C. But now you should also keep in mind that if I have some operator here, I can somehow move it to the left or to the right.
Can you tell, why should I think of that as A tensor C in the first place? I wouldn't have made.
I mean, imagine there's no bulk, right?
There's no bulk, okay.
Then, and I put the two lines next to each other. This is the epsilon line is C, and this line is A.
Okay.
So you might think and then if I just have the two lines next to each other without the bulk, this would be A tensor C.
Okay.
Right? And now we try to figure out what happens if we add the bulk.
Okay.
So there are some operators in the bulk. And if I'm in the sandwich, it's somehow the same operator if I move this to the left or to the right.
Okay.
And so this is what this relative tensor product does. It's just the ordinary tensor product. And then you divide out relations which look like A acted on with some B tensor lambda. You identify this with having B on the other side. So this would be epsilon of B. And you divide out this relation. This is what this relative tensor product does, or what the sandwich construction does.
And what is this action? action in the sense of, well, yeah. What
I mean, in the field theory, it means you move a point to the boundary, or an bulk operator to the boundary, something like that.
Is that emphasizing the module structure aspect?
Yeah, yeah. This is what it means to be a module, right? Module is like something, module over an algebra is something where I have a map from A tensor M to M.
Yeah, so here you would have two modules, A and epsilon? And,
yeah.
Well, epsilon of C or, like, I know that, or C.
I mean,
C is the other module.
C is the module and epsilon describes the action of A on C. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can move here or there. Uh-huh. And then this relative tensor power somehow what the sandwich construction in 2D would do for you. And so I should make this more clear. These transversal boundary conditions, sometimes they just don't exist. But some algebras don't have an augmentation, or in the Diophantine case, some co-circuits are just not trivial. So you cannot always form this. But if you have such a transversal boundary condition, you can gauge the symmetry or take a quotient by the symmetry. And this is just defined as so it's in formulas, it's like epsilon tensor F tilde over sigma. Or as a picture, this means we now put instead of rho, we put epsilon as a boundary condition. And then we perform a sandwich like this. Okay, and then can state a statement about this construction, which is essentially if I look at the example of Diophantine theory. So my keys consists of some finite gauge theory. My Dirichlet boundary condition corresponds to this map from a point to BG. So this just says all bundles are trivialized on the boundary. And then then epsilon is just the map, the identity map from BG to BG. Then what I can, and I have some boundary theory. So this should be in quotation marks. This is not like that precise. But then I can ask what is F gauged epsilon for this Diophantine theory. And I can ask what is this? This is a new theory which will give me something evaluated, some type of partition function evaluated on a manifold M. And what this is, so let's say this is top dimensional. Then the statement is that this is an integral over G bundles on M. Now we call that a boundary theory for Diophantine theory, just an ordinary field theory defined a coupled to G background fields. So I can ask like, sum over principal G bundles, but then because F tilde was a boundary for my Diophantine theory, it's defined for, it's something defined for G bundles. And then I can integrate over all G bundles. And yeah, this is the answer I get. And this is exactly what gauging would do, that you somehow first couple to background fields, and then you integrate over all possible background fields. So you make them dynamical. Or make them dynamical. Let me just sketch how this is, how one can show a statement like this. Proof sketch is essentially what we should figure out is so I have my boundary epsilon. And then I can look what Diophantine theory with epsilon So I put the boundary condition epsilon here and some manifold M on the other side. And now I can evaluate the theory on this, which will give me some element in whatever Dyckerff-Witten theory assigns to M. So this is a space, and this was it's a vector space, the vector space of functions on G bundles on M with values in C. And since epsilon as a boundary condition just is somehow doesn't restrict the field at all, the function we will get is just the constant function 1. Right? I mean, so the function is somehow I have a bundle here, and then I integrate over the free image here, which has the specified boundary condition here, and this is either 1, or if the boundary condition would be a point, it would only be 1 on the trivial bundle. That's what we used last time. So this whole thing is just the map which maps P to 1, and this is for all principal bundles. And now, what is the sandwich type of thing we want to do? It's just a pairing between this, let's just call this thing phi epsilon. So there's this function depending on epsilon, and it's a pairing between phi epsilon and whatever f tilde is. Right? Recall f tilde was also an element in this space, and now I pair these two things together. And the pairing was defined as an integral over G bundles on M. So I integrate, and then I do phi epsilon on P f tilde of P, which is, depends on M. And since this function is constantly 1, we end up with the formula up there. And this is just equal to 1. And so in this special case, this just recovers exactly what you would call gauging, right, of a symmetry. But you can now do this for more general theories as well. Okay. And now, I mean, what we will do in the rest of today's lecture is just somehow try to get some information about the gauge theory from looking at this quiche picture. And the first thing we want to understand is what are the potential domain walls between the gauge theory and the original theory. So we have our boundary condition rho, then there's the boundary condition epsilon, there's the bulk sigma, and then yellow, and then there's the theory f tilde on this side. And what we try to understand are what are the codimension 1 defects we can put at this position. And as similar to how what we did last week is to figure out what are the potential codimension 1 defects, we can look at a type of operator state correspondence, so we can cut out a small small neighborhood of the thing we want to study and look at the state space on this. So somehow data is the same as the state space of the theory sigma on an interval which has an epsilon boundary condition here, and then we go from epsilon to rho. So there's a rho boundary condition on this side. And this will be some vector space, and delta will be some element in this vector space. Okay. But now these boundary conditions were assumed to be transverse by construction. So this is just the complex number. These are just the complex numbers. So I have a unique I have a preferred element in here, which gives me a preferred defect delta. So there's somehow there's a canonical defect between the Neumann and the Dirichlet boundary condition, which we call delta. And then the same argument gives us another defect, which goes from rho to epsilon. So there's a second defect, which we call delta star. And this would be constructed by cutting out another interval and also using that the boundary conditions are transversal. Okay. And now if I look at the sandwich picture, right, if I do the sandwich here, I get F. If I do it here, I get the gauge theory. Here, I get F again. So I get F, and I get F modulo sigma, and I get F again, and I get point co-dimension one defects, delta and delta star between them. So there's a preferred defect between F and the gauge theory F modulo. Epsilon, okay.
But wait, before, because I somehow, okay, doing the, okay, the quiche with the, or it's like a different quiche now with a different boundary condition.
You do a different sandwich, yes.
And that gives you the gauged version?
Yeah, this gauges the symmetry.
Why?
I mean, somehow in this example, it does what it does, right? But also what it, I mean,
also, I don't understand the example, so.
Okay.
But maybe you can if you can translate it, but I don't know.
But I mean, what somehow, right? What this epsilon does, it somehow sets the symmetry to be trivial, right? It somehow says all of them are trivial, they are all mapped to C somehow, something like that, right? It's right. This being trivial, you might think of epsilon trivializing the symmetry or something like that. So you somehow enforce the symmetry to be trivial, or you take a quotient by it. And this is what gauging is, right? Gauging, if you look at the state space, you really take G invariant states or something like that.
Yeah.
So in this sense, this epsilon takes the quotient by the symmetry. Right. For example, if you have an augmentation like this for the group algebra, this construction would really just be taking G invariants. If you have a theory, which with a G action, this would at the level of vector spaces just take G invariants, and this is what gauging is supposed to do.
Is there? Well, I don't know if you could go this example again. So, yeah.
I can do that. Let me maybe first go through the statement.
Yeah.
So what's the setup? There's a quiche, which is a finite gauge theory in n plus one dimension, and then there's a boundary condition. So if I have the boundary condition says something. If I have some m, and that's my boundary sigma.
And I should not think of the sigma as the initial state. Anyway.
It's not an initial state. It's a boundary. So I want, and I label it with this boundary condition. Let's maybe call it D, and color it red. So there's this fixed boundary condition here I have. And then this should just be a complex number. And what it is, it's an integral.
Wait, why should that be a complex number?
Because let's say this is topped, it's n plus one dimensional. And there's boundary condition, right? And then you could just compute a path integral over all fields satisfying the boundary condition.
So I'm just saying, because usually Z of something is the vector space associated to it.
Or if you're in top dimension, it's a complex number associated to it, right? It's.
Is it?
I mean, we just denote that to say it's like the field theory evaluated on this geometric object. And if the geometric object is a spacetime, you would expect a number. And if it's a co-dimension one slice, you would expect a vector space. And now this
partition function.
Yeah, it's a partition function.
Yeah. So I suppose it's also thought from the functoral perspective is a transition from the vacuum to the vacuum. Or?
Yeah, this is exactly. This would be from the vacuum to the vacuum because this is a like
you put no states.
Yeah.
Since you put no states, okay.
Yeah, so there's just a boundary condition, no state. And then this is an integral now over fields on M. So fields are G bundles on M, right?
Okay.
But then there's a condition on the field at the boundary. The condition is if I take the field and I restrict it to the boundary, then I want this to be trivial. So this is the trivial bundle saying B times G. So I somehow now not integrate over all G bundles on this manifold, I only integrate over those satisfying
this. Sigma times G?
Yes. Sorry, this should be sigma times G. It's a trivial bundle on sigma. And then I integrate whatever my action function is, but in this case it's just one.
Okay.
So this is somehow what this quiche does.
Okay.
And now I can ask what are not necessarily topological right boundary conditions for this one. So what are all the possible right boundary conditions I can have? And last time we have seen that these are exactly quantum field theories in general, not necessarily topological, which are coupled to G background fields. So they make, I can evaluate them on a manifold, on the manifold M, which now might have additional structure, like a Riemannian metric or so on, which you need to define the thing. But then in addition, it's coupled to some G background fields, P. So this is somehow what the boundary theory is. And then gauging, the statement is if I use this gauging procedure by putting an epsilon at the boundary, then this is the same as what you would usually do, which is just perform a path integral over all gauge fields.
Can we clarify what the notation on the left means for a second? Is F, what is F?
Also, dimensions are bad here, I'm sorry. This is N plus one, while this M here is N dimensional.
Okay.
F is just a quantum field theory with this quiche as a symmetry.
Quantum theory with that quiche at the symmetry.
Yes.
And somehow you take that, you mod out, you gauge it with the epsilon, and
yeah.
Then you evaluate it on the Z. What is it?
So I take this quotient by the symmetry.
Yeah.
This is a new n-dimensional quantum field theory. So I can evaluate it on n-dimensional manifolds. So the dimensions are bad. Here M is n plus one dimensional, here it's n dimensional. But I can evaluate it on an n-dimensional manifold M.
Okay.
It should give me some partition function. And the statement is the partition function is the old one, and then which is defined in the presence of background fields, and then I perform a path integral over all the fields. So this is exactly what you would do if you gauge a symmetry, right? You integrate over all the gauge fields. Modulo gauge group, but this is somehow encoded in how this integration was defined.
Okay, so it's summing over all. Somehow it should be summing over all gauge fields, okay?
Yeah.
There's an analogy there, okay.
So this is what this construction.
Okay.
Yeah, and then here we just try to argue what we can know about the gauge theory just from looking at things happening in the quiche. And we can, for example, argue that there are these defects between the original theory and the gauge theory, which are delta and delta star. Another thing we can do abstractly is we can...
This delta and delta star gauge and ungauge the theory, it seems, up until this... After.
No, just a defect, right? This is not an... It's just a defect between the gauged and the ungauged theory. The gauged theory and the ungauged theory. So you have some type of defect between them. Another thing we can do is We cannot gauge on a full space-time, but we can gauge on some sub-manifold. So for example, if I only want to gauge around this line, what I can do is I can look at a small neighborhood of the line. Here I put the boundary condition epsilon. And then here I can put something like delta star and delta. And if I do the sandwich construction with that, I somehow have only gauged the symmetry on the sub-manifold here. So we can also, so there's this thing Z, right, this sub-manifold here, let's call it Z. And this type of construction allows me to gauge the symmetry on the sub-manifold. So this would be something. I just have this one line, Z, and only on the line I have gauged the symmetry. So you can also gauge symmetries only on certain submanifolds if you want. Okay.
Physically, how do you gauge a symmetry just in a submanifold? Like, I don't know if I understand that.
Do I understand what this means? I mean, it means something like this. Which is not that helpful, right? But I mean, you can think of gauging a symmetry as somehow inserting enough defect lines, and you might not insert the defects in the whole manifold, you just insert them on some subregion, right? So if you have like something like a point, you might only insert defects in a small neighborhood of that point. And then the gauging is topological, so you can move these things. I mean, yeah, I should also have said these operators, they are topological, right? So I can move there. They are flexible to move around. I would agree that's not.
Physically, I would have like, because if I think I gauge a symmetry, like I is what you said before. I don't have physical states anymore that that are not invariant. But here you are saying, okay, in that line, all your physical states are in that quotient, but
outside they can they can be fixed. You can have somehow background fields outside, but then at this line, you integrate over all the gauge fields compatible with it.
Okay,
and then something which happens sometimes, which has a specific name. So we can just look at a situation where the gauge theory is actually isomorphic to the original theory. But in general, this will not happen, but sometimes this happens. But if I gauge a symmetry, I get just the original symmetry, a theory back. And then this allows us to define so-called duality defects. Delta. And they are defined as using this defect between Neumann and Dirichlet boundary condition, and then composing it with the isomorphism of field theories. And now this is a defect in the theory F, right? Delta goes from F to the gauge theory, but then there's this isomorphism going back to the original theory. And then this is a defect, and it's going to be topological.
Delta goes from where to where, sorry?
Let me maybe.
Delta can go from somewhere to somewhere else.
Right, so I have. So I have my theory F, right? And then I have the defect small delta, which goes from F to F to the gauge theory.
Okay.
But now this theory is actually isomorphic to F. So I can use this isomorphism to make delta a defect between F and itself. So to say it's a defect between itself, and this type of isomorphism is usually some type of duality. So that's why this is called a duality defect. And if there's time, you will see how this works in the Ising model. So in the Ising model, this is like this Carmer-Vanier duality defect at a critical temperature. So the Ising model, if you do this gauging, what it does, it somehow exchanges low temperatures with high temperatures. And then there's a critical point where the dual temperature is the original temperature. And at this point, you have these type of duality defects. And it's, again, it's a topological defect. Okay.
Sometimes a duality maps one theory to a different theory.
Usually a duality maps one theory to a different theory.
So this is not...
But this is now, I mean, this is more like something you get if your theory is safe dual, right? It might happen that you have a duality, but then the theory you get is actually the theory you started with.
Okay, like, and then, not all dualities look like this.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. I mean, usually it's just, you do this, and then you get something depending on a different parameter, right? Like in the Ising model, right, you have somehow, depends on some temperature, and then you have a Z2 symmetry, which you can gauge. And then what you will get is that this is a theory at the dual temperature, but then at the critical temperature, you have this extra isomorphism, which gives you this duality defect. So this is somehow, these are some constructions you can abstractly do in the symmetry TFT whenever you have, whenever you look at some gauging. Let me just mention something which is called a dual symmetry. So if you gauge a finite symmetry, then I get, in the gauge theory, I get new line operators, which I can, Wilson line type operators, which I can label with representations of G. And what the partition function for the gauge theory somehow does, if I want to insert this operator, but the gauge theory was an integral over G bundles on M, and then I have something I integrate. But then in addition, I just add something like the trace in the representation V of the holonomy along gamma of my bundle. So I can insert Wilson line operators. So, and if the group G is finite, these are topological. So whenever I have a gauge theory, there are new topological operators corresponding to Wilson lines. So there is a, and then if you count dimensions, line operators are something like a D minus 2 form symmetry. So if you gauge a finite gauge theory, you always have some type of dual symmetry. And a way of seeing this in the Kiesch picture is, what I can do is I can look at my boundary epsilon. Then I have sigma. Now you should think of sigma as being something like an algebra and epsilon something like a module. So I can look at the endomorphisms of epsilon as a sigma module. So what are these? These are somehow operators I can insert here. So these are exactly like the codimension one operators we can insert in epsilon. So I can look this. But now since I have taken something like the endomorphisms, they actually act on epsilon themselves. So I get here, I get another theory, which is something like the endomorphisms of sigma epsilon. And then this, now if I have F here, then this type of picture, now I can do the dimensional reduction here. So this combines to F modulo sigma, and then, but now this is a boundary on this new thing. So it's a boundary for the endomorphisms sigma of epsilon. And for example, in 3D, if sigma is like, let's say, a Diagraph-Witten theory based on an abelian group, BA, then this dual theory, so sigma dual, would be the Diagraph-Witten theory based on B squared A. Okay. Okay, that was probably a bit quick, but somehow if you gauge the symmetry, the statement somehow that there naturally appears a new thing you can think of as a new symmetry, TFT. So there's a dual symmetry showing up. And this is what encodes these line operators. Okay, and the last
thing. This work also in, like this works for every physical theory in which Wilson lines are topological?
Yes, if your Wilson lines are topological, you will always get a D minus two form symmetry in the gauge theory.
And can you think the same, like for example, in gauge theories, like if instead of considering Wilson lines, you consider surface operators?
Yeah.
Like Young Mills always has this Gukov-Witten surface operators.
Yeah.
I think that when the gauge group is abelian, they are topological, I think.
Okay, yeah.
So can you think also those as dual symmetry of something or no?
Probably, yes. I mean, it depends a bit on the dimension. You can definitely think of them as being some type of symmetry. So for example, I'm not sure if that's the case, but Young-Mills theory always has a one form Z of G symmetry. And then I can gauge the symmetry, and the gauge theory would be something like G mod ZG. And then this is a one form symmetry. So in four dimensions, there would be a dual.
Yeah, I think
something symmetry.
Operators.
Ah, okay, yeah.
And can you relate this with S-duality? Like, is there?
I think so, yes. But not now. I think there's an example in the paper by Reed, Moore, Telemann, where they exactly do S-duality for Young-Mills. But there are also certain things where you, somehow if you do S-duality, your coupling is at a fixed point for that, and then you get a duality defect of this type. And it's discussed in their paper, but I don't recall the details. So the last thing I wanted to do is just to look at the Ising model a bit and see how these things look in this specific example. So for this, so the Ising, I mean, there are a lot of ways of describing the Ising model, but we will do some statistical mechanics version. So first we fix some function theta, on the group with two elements, which takes values in the positive real numbers, in the sense, so I think of Z2 as the group of with elements plus minus one, and it maps this to E plus minus beta, and beta I think of some type of inverse temperature. This is somehow what specifies the model. And then in addition, we fix a surface sigma and a lattice lambda in sigma. But the Ising model is some lattice model, so sigma is a surface, lambda is a lattice, so lattice consists of some vertices, edges, and faces. Let me draw an example. So our surface sigma is something like T2. So it's a torus, and I identify the boundaries. And then lambda might be a square lattice. So something like this. And then this has some vertices, which are the points here. It has some edges, which I call E, and then it has some faces, which are the things. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I mean, right, this has periodic boundary conditions, so going from here to here is one edge. Okay. And now to write down the Ising model, first I say, what is the classical configuration? It's a field, and this is a map from V to Z2. So to every vertex, I assign some type of spin. It's like either plus or minus one. And S labels all the vertices with a spin. Based on that, we can write down the partition function for the Ising model, which is a sum over all S. So it's a sum over all the possible spin labels on these vertices. And then I sum certain action, and so I sum E, a sum over all edges. And the Ising model, if I have two vertices connected by an edge, it should be energetically favorable for them to align. And it should be not favorable to disalign. So how we do this is we write down this theta term, so we do E to the beta, and then I do something like I can look, I evaluate S, so S assigns to every vertex a spin, and I evaluate S at the start point of my edge, and then I evaluate it also at the end point. So I compare, look at this, if this is E, I look at the spin here and multiply it with the spin there. If they align, this product is 1. If they disalign, this product is minus 1. So this gives a weight depending on whether the spins align or not. Okay, and this is the partition function for the Ising model.
It says Z of S.
This should not be S. This is Z of S. This is Z of
sigma lambda or something.
This is, yeah, exactly. And then this thing is what I call Z of S.
And
okay.
So, is it, does the, so is, are the lattice sites defect? Or should I simply say that it's a lattice and we're just defining the Ising model in the way to know?
Yeah, it's,
but
it's a model defined on a surface which is equipped with the structure of the lattice. It's not really a defect.
Yeah.
You might, I mean, right, there are ways of building these models by thinking of defects in the boundary or something like that.
Yeah, no, and I'm just asking because I don't know to what degree I should use the instincts of the, you know, the functorial nature of the Zs and all of that. And
I mean, this is now just a partition function.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like it, yeah.
I'm just writing down the partition function for the Ising model. So far. And so the statement is now that we have the Ising model, but this actually sits on the boundary of a three-dimensional finite gauge theory for Z2. So the statement is that this is the boundary theory for a Dyer-Witten theory with gauge group Z2. And what does this mean? It means that, as we have now seen a few times, somehow we should be able to define the partition function in a situation where there is a Z2 bundle on sigma. Right, so this is, P is some Z2 bundle over sigma. Z2 bundle on sigma. And I now need to define something I want to call. So we want to define some ZMP lambda. Okay. And for this, the first thing we do is we redefine this what S is. So right here, you should think of having P being trivial, meaning the fiber of the principal bundle over any vertex is canonically identified with Z2. But if we have a non-trivial Z2 bundle, this might not be the case. And I just define S now to be a map from V to this principal bundle restricted at V, such that S composed with this projection pi is the identity. So to every vertex, I assign an element in the fiber of the principal bundle. And the main statement, I mean, the thing which makes everything work is that this expression still makes sense. Even though the fiber is not defined as an element in Z2, if I have two fibers and an edge between them, I can look at the parallel transport of the value here to the value to here, and then I can compare it to the other element I fixed. And their difference will be an element of the group. So we can actually write down the same partition function, which now depends on P. So we can write this down again as a sum over all S, where S is now defined in this way, a product over all edges. And then I do what I just now, instead of writing e to the beta something, I just write theta of, and now I just look at the parallel transport along E. And this notation means I look at what S assigns to the starting point of the edge and compare it with what it assigns to the endpoint. And then, so I take this, I parallel transport it to the endpoint, and then I compare. And this is either plus or minus one. So I can write down this action functional as well. Okay.
What are we doing right now? We're trying to.
I mean, so.
It seems like we're putting some sort of background.
We turn on a background gauge field for the Ising model. So we define an Ising model now in the presence of some non-trivial Z2 bundle on sigma. And now.
What does it mean to parallel transport in these cases? Like, because also the trajectory is discrete as well, right? Or no? Should I imagine there's a continuous manifold between the points?
I mean, there's an edge between the points, right?
Yeah.
So the picture is where you have these two points, and then you have an edge between the points, so there's a path between the two points. And you can parallel transport along the path.
So I should think of these points living in a... Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm thinking about, but yeah, because since there is, so yeah, when I have a continuous thing, I know that all connections are flat. Therefore, if I have a, if I'm at a given point and I lift it, that somehow I can move, I think there's a well-defined notion of how to move around, but if I make jumps, I feel like going from one side to the other, I could go to one up or down, and there's a bit of an ambiguity because of the discreteness.
Right, like if I just look at the edge, right, my bundle might look like this. This might how it would look as a fiber over the edge.
Yeah.
And then parallel transport would send this point to this one, and this point to that one.
So the edge somehow prescribes a way to connect the points? That's what the edge
does? Yeah, the edge is a path from this point to that point in the manifold.
Okay, so they do live in a manifold. Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
I mean, the whole lattice lives in the surface sigma. And I mean, now this again, what the whole thing means is that now we should have a picture where there's like a three-dimensional Z2 gauge theory living in the bike here, and then there's a lattice on the boundary. And this define, okay, this is, the picture is not good, but some Z2 digraph Witten theory sitting here, and then there's a, on the boundary, there's a, it's the Ising model. So and then we can ask, what is the Ising model? Now I can gauge this Z2 symmetry. Let's say the Ising model, right, it depended on this choice of beta. And now the exercise is that this is actually the Ising model for the dual temperature, and the dual temperature is defined by satisfying this equation. So this is how the original temperature and the dual temperature are related. And this is exercise. And in general, right, this also depended on the lattice lambda. And this will depend on the dual lattice. So if you have any lattice in a surface, the dual lattice is constructed as follows. For every face, you add a vertex. And then for every edge, you add an edge. And the faces become, the vertices become faces of the dual lattice. So this in blue would be, this would be lambda dual. And it turns out in this case, the dual symmetry is again going to be Z2. So there's a dual Z2 symmetry, which we can use to go back. And the last thing to mention is that, this is a good place. I mean, so at the dual, add this. So at beta, this beta dual, there's now the gauge theory is isomorphic to the original one. So at this critical temperature, we will find a duality. Defect delta, and this is something which was known before. This is sometimes called the Kramers Vanier duality. Somehow this framework and this general story restricts to well-known things in the Ising model. And this, one can go on and study surface align operators in the Ising model and how they behave under the duality And so on. One can look at the dual symmetry. As I said, this would again be a Z2 symmetry. And so on. But I think this is the point where I'm going to stop. So thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. And if you have any questions, let me know.
Yeah, for sure. So I don't know. I'm struggling to grasp today's concepts, and I don't know if the easing model could be a good place to just.
Yeah.
Does it capture all the concepts we went through today?
Yes. You can use any and everything we learned today. You can make explicit in the Ising model. Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, the Ising model is it? How does it fit within the things we were talking about before? It's a theory.
It's a theory. Yes.
Topological theory.
It's a non-topological theory. Yes.
It's a non-topological theory.
Which depends on the choice of a lattice on your manifold. But you might take a limit where you make the lattice really fine, and then
you get a CFT or something.
You get a CFT if you're at the critical point.
Yeah.
And at the other point, you get something boring.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know exactly how I should think of this theory, because I was thinking before I would think of metrics and manifolds, but this one is a discrete one, and
yeah.
The piece of data depends on it's a lattice. Okay.
It's a lattice, yeah.
And it assigns to it a partition function, a number.
Yeah, and it would also assign a Hilbert space to codimension one manifolds, which is just something like we had the definition of fields, and then something like functions on these fields, but there are finitely many fields. If I have a fixed lattice with finitely many vertices, and then functions on this are well-defined Hilbert space.
So I'd imagine I have the boundary would have
you would have some
circle, I don't know, and it would have a finite number of spin sites.
Yeah.
And okay.
And then you have like a finite number of configurations, and then functions on this, so you would get something Z2. Something like that, right? This would be a Hilbert space.
Okay, so that's a theory.
That's a theory, yes.
Okay, so what's the next step?
The next step is that there's also a quiche, right? Which is a 3D theory with a topological boundary, and the 3D theory is...
it's written already, I don't know.
Is Dijkgraaf-Witten theory with its Dirichlet boundary condition for the group Z2.
Okay, I don't know exactly. So this is going to be related to a Z2 symmetry, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, we started with a Z2 group, but you can start with another group, then you would get here like Zn gauge theory or something like that.
Okay.
So the setting is that there's a bulk, which is the finite gauge theory for the Z2, and this has a boundary condition, which is the Dirichlet boundary condition.
You said the bulk is what?
It's a finite gauge theory with gauge group Z2.
I don't get this stuff. Because there are two things that are happening in parallel. One, there's symmetry. Two, we're somehow adding a background gauge field and some background field.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
And somehow the Dijkgraaf-Witten is associated to which one? To defining the symmetry or to defining the background?
So there is a quiche, which makes sense independently of the Ising model. Right? There's a three-dimensional topological field theory, which is a finite gauge theory based on Z2. And this has a topological boundary condition. So this is just a quiche, which just exists. And now there's also the Ising model. And now you can ask, is the Ising model a theory on a boundary of this quiche? And the statement we've seen last week is, if I look at a boundary theory on a Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, that's the same as coupling the boundary to a gauge field.
Okay, and by the way, when you couple the backgrounds, normally I would like to divide that in two steps. There's the coupling to a non-dynamical background and then engaging the background.
Yeah, here it's just non-dynamical, right?
Because the quiche, because of the specific boundary conditions we chose for the quiche?
Yes.
Somehow that's included there, okay.
Yeah, right, also I mean the thing I wrote down here, right? This is just, I fixed some background field and then I write down a partition function, but I'm not doing any type of integration over the background field.
Yeah.
So, and then the statement is somehow that this setting, it's the same as having like the sandwich picture here.
Okay. Is there a way to translate that? Okay, so somehow the fact that over sigma we mounted a Z2 bundle, then...
Yeah.
Should there be a section associated to something? The thing you drew is I associated more with sections, maybe, or not, or do I not?
What do you associate with sections?
A specific curve, like the curve you drew between the edges. It's like a parallel transfer, but... Okay, but okay, fair enough. You mounted the entire structure over it, okay?
Yeah.
And it's connected. Okay. What am I saying? I don't know. Okay, can you say a little bit more about how this picture is related to putting a background field?
Yeah. Should probably have recalled that today. But the question is somehow, what are boundary theories for a Diagraph-Witten theory? And generally, if I want to understand boundaries in a topological field theory, like Diagraph-Witten theory, what I can do is I can look at something which looks like this. So I have a boundary, but then I also have, so I want to use something like an operator state correspondence. So I want to identify my boundary condition with a state on the same manifold as the boundary. Right, so I can evaluate the field theory on a bordism like this. This is a bordism from the empty set to whatever this is. Let's call this thing sigma, for example. So instead of to specify a boundary condition, I can also specify some state on sigma. So this is a map from C to Diagraph-Witten theory on sigma. But now what's this vector space here? Is just functions on G bundles on sigma with values in C. So an element in the vector space Diagraph-Witten theory assigns to sigma is something which is coupled to G bundles on sigma, right? Because it's a function which to every G bundle assigns a complex number. So it's a partition function which is coupled to G bundles.
Okay.
So in this sense, boundary conditions really just are the same as coupling to gauge fields.
There's a problem that I just need to also just familiarize myself more with.
Yeah.
Diagraph-Witten. What's on here? But fair enough. But okay, so something that I understood there is that I can assign, there's an assignment, I'm failing to see, make it precise. There's an assignment. So if I have a boundary condition, a boundary theory, what is the red circle?
The red thing is a boundary condition or boundary theory.
It's a boundary theory.
Let's say boundary theory. This is the thing we call F tilde, I think.
Somehow there's an assignment. I can always attach that into a cylinder that has sigma.
Yeah.
As a final place.
Yeah.
So this is a transition between something and something. And
so this gives you a map from boundary conditions to states.
Yeah.
And then states are functions like this. So these are things which partition functions defined in the presence of background fields.
Okay. Okay. The gauging comes when you, I suppose one has to change the...
Yeah, and then you can put in the other boundary condition and this will sum over all these things.
And with that, would she be able to prove the duality somehow between the two?
Yes.
That alone.
I mean, I should probably have mentioned one other reason people like these symmetry TFTs is that quite often they, it's also something which shows up naturally in physics. So if you have holography, but you already have a bulk, so you have something in the bulk, and then you can just try to make that topological, and this somehow gives you the symmetry TFT. So it's something you can compute easily. Also, if you do geometric engineering and string theory, where you like do some compactification type thing or some like cigar thing, right? There's something at a point, and then there's a lot of things in the bulk, and then you can somehow compute in the bulk what the symmetry TFT is. So it's something which actually has in a lot of stringy situations is something one can compute. And it's natural to compute. There's like this higher dimension where you can try to figure out what are the topological things. Was derailing the question a bit, but I think this is why some people in physics like this as an approach. Right? You might not even really know what your theory is if you do like dimensional reduction or something like that, but you might still be able to compute its symmetries this way.
Thank you.